And on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to this teleclass, Disinfection and Sterilization Guidelines, What You Need to Know. For many hundreds of you, this will be your first teleclass experience, and I must say you've picked a good one. For this audience, Dr. William Rotella needs no introduction. His research and publications on the topic of surface disinfection and sterilization really form the cornerstone of national and international infection control guidelines. He is a regular speaker at conferences all over the world, and for all that greatness, he's also a very nice guy. You have his slides in front of you, and you can see there's a lot of stuff to cover, so I'll not ramble on too long. But before Bill begins, let me also say a word of thanks to Virox Technologies for sponsoring this teleclass. The guys at Virox have been great supporters of the teleclass education program for many years, and we're tremendously grateful again for their sponsorship today. To Randy, John, Nicole, Robert, everyone at Virox, thank you very much indeed. Now, to present disinfection and sterilization, what you need to know. From the University of North Carolina, it is an honor to once again present Dr. William Rotella. Bill.
Thank you very much, Paul, and good afternoon. And thank you all for joining me to discuss this topic of disinfection and sterilization guidelines, what you need to know. If you look at the next slide, what we're going to do over the next hour is provide an overview of disinfection and sterilization recommendations and review the significant revisions in this guideline compared to the 1985 disinfection and sterilization guideline from the Centers for Disease Control. Those revisions involve topics such as surface disinfection, emerging pathogens and prions, endoscope reprocessing, and, of course, the important topic of how to reprocess semi-critical equipment, such as endocavitary probes. The next slide will tell you where to get these slides if you don't already have them. There's a website entitled disinfectionandsterilization.org, and these slides are available, as well as other sets of slides, at that website. Now, the next slide will just go over, essentially, an overview of the disinfection and sterilization guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control. We don't have a lot of time to mention all that's on this slide, but I do want to mention it's a very comprehensive guideline containing almost 300 pages with about 21 pages of recommendations with over 1,100 references, and hopefully it'll be published very soon. As you may notice on the slide, it was cleared by HCPAC in February of 2003, and we hope it's going to be published in late July of 2007, so hopefully any day, any week, any month. Now, the next slide will just go through some influencing factors, and certainly we don't have enough time to spend the hour or two that we could on influencing factors, but I do want to emphasize to you, as you already know, that it is extremely important that items such as semi-critical items and critical items, which we'll discuss in a moment, are clean before, of course, those items undergo a high-level disinfection or sterilization process. And, of course, cleaning is done by a number of procedures, which we'll discuss, but all of those procedures do two important things. Of course, they reduce organic and inorganic load, and, of course, they reduce the microbial load associated with medical instruments. The next slide is a little cartoon, and it says, don't you ever wash your weapons before you use them? It says, no, why? And the answer is you could give someone an infection. And, of course, what we're talking about is giving someone an infection unless we wash or clean our semi-critical or critical instruments prior to high-level disinfection or sterilization, respectively. The next slide just shows a washer disinfector, and I want to mention to you how very effective these washer disinfectors are. These washer disinfectors are extremely effective. We've recently completed a study which demonstrates that you can put as many as a million or 10 million organisms on instruments, and when they go through these washer disinfectors, they're completely devoid of microbial contamination. Now, sometimes you can't use an automated washer disinfector, and the next slide will just show a manual cleaning for some instruments that allow for a manual but not automated washing. The next slide is a very important slide, which looks at essentially the rationale for the entire guideline on disinfection and sterilization. In fact, I would say that this is by far the most important slide in this slide set because it essentially identifies for any one of us that are users of instruments in healthcare how to disinfect or sterilize an instrument in healthcare. And what it says is when you are asked the question about how to disinfect an item, you need to ask yourself what is the intended use of that item. And you can see that there's three types of items. First, items are critical items. And of course, critical items contact or enter normally sterile tissue or the vascular system or through which a sterile body fluid such as blood will flow. And because any microbial contamination could result in disease transmission, these critical items must be sterile. Now, the semi-critical items are going to have contact with mucous membranes or skin that is not intact, and they require a disinfection process that we refer to as high-level disinfection. And when we perform high-level disinfection on semi-critical items, we kill all microorganisms but high numbers of bacterial spores. So we kill all the bacteria, the mycobacteria, and the viruses, and the fungi, but we don't kill high numbers of bacterial spores, but for all intents and purposes, that does not represent a clinically significant issue. Now, the last category are the non-critical items, and they touch only intact skin, and there we're going to either do low-level disinfection or we're going to clean the surface with a detergent that has no antimicrobial activity. So it's very important that we ask the question, how is the item going to be used? When we're asked the question, how do you disinfect X or Y, we need to think, is it going into sterile tissue? If it is, it needs to be sterile, and it's a critical item. If it's going into mucous membranes or skin that is not intact, then it's considered a semi-critical item requiring high-level disinfection. And if it's only touching intact skin, then it's considered non-critical, for which we either do low-level disinfection or we do essentially a detergent cleaning of that non-critical item touching only intact skin. Now, the next slide just shows some critical items that are heat resistant and can be steam sterilized. The slide after will essentially just give an overview of critical items. We already alluded to the fact that the objective is sterility. We've alluded to the fact that there's going to be contact with sterile tissue or the vascular system and a sterile body fluid flows through this particular instrument. And we're killing all microorganisms without exception, and we generally do it as shown on the bottom of the slide by something like steam sterilization, gas sterilization, which is like an ethylene oxide process, hydrogen peroxide gas plasma, and then in some situations we may use chemical sterilization such as a peracetic acid immersion system. The next slide just shows you a few critical items that I'm sure you're familiar with, such as critical instruments, surgical instruments that are critical, cardiac catheters, and of course implants, all of which would have contact with sterile tissue or sterile body fluid would flow through them. And the slide after that just gives us some idea of how we would achieve chemical sterilization of a critical object if we really had to use chemicals. Now, as I alluded to, generally we don't use chemicals for achieving sterilization of critical objects with the exception of the peracetic acid system. Most of the other systems take a great deal of time. And then, of course, once it is exposed to the sterilant for a sufficient time, then it would need to be rinsed with sterile water, dried with sterile air, and, of course, packaged or delivered to a patient in a way that would present a sterile item to the patient. So that's why we typically don't use chemical sterilization of critical items. We typically use things like terminal sterilization processes such as steam, ethylene oxide, and hydrogen peroxide gas plasma. The next slide shows a person with a semi-critical item, and of course this semi-critical item is an endoscope, and it's an endoscope which of course has contact with mucous membranes, and we can see on the following slide that of course these semi-critical items that touch mucous membranes, we are going to essentially eliminate all microorganisms with the exception of high numbers of bacterial spores. And we're going to do that by a process that we refer to as high-level disinfection. And, of course, that is done for any number of semi-critical items. And the next slide will identify some of those semi-critical items that are in your patient care area, such as endoscopes, whether they're GI scopes or bronchoscopes, respiratory therapy equipment, anesthesia equipment, endocavitary probes, which we're going to discuss more, tonometers, which we're going to discuss more, or something like diaphragm fitting rings, which of course all have contact with the mucous membrane, and of course we need to use FDA-cleared high-level disinfectants or chemical sterilants, which are shown on the following slide. In the United States, we have certain products that are cleared by the Food and Drug Administration as high-level disinfectants or chemical sterilants. You should be looking at a slide that's entitled High-Level Disinfection of Semi-Critical Objects, and it gives you a list of most of the high-level disinfectants or chemical sterilants that are in the marketplace. You can see that the products include things such as glutaraldehyde and ortho-thaldehyde. They are the two most commonly used products, but you can see also some other products, such as hydrogen peroxide and peracetic acid, and hypochlorite. Now, you can also see associated with some of those germicides that there's an asterisk, and that asterisk means that while those compounds, those high-level disinfectants or chemical sterilants, are extremely effective in killing microorganisms, those compounds are oxidizing agents and may cause some cosmetic and functional damage to an instrument such as an endoscope. So we just need to be cautious if we use some of those high-level disinfectants that are listed with an asterisk that we don't cause any deleterious effects or we don't essentially modify the functionality of the instrument that we're using. Now, the other point on this slide is the exposure time. And in the United States, essentially, we have various exposure times. For example, ortho-thaldehyde has a 12-minute recommendation. In other parts of the world, with the exception of the United States and Canada, it's actually 5 minutes for ortho-thaldehyde. But if you're living in the United States, the exposure time for ortho-thaldehyde is 12 minutes. Now, for glutaraldehyde, the exposure time from many professional organizations and which will be recommended in the CDC guidelines is 20 minutes to 20 degrees centigrade. And of course, you would have to look at the package insert for the other exposure time for the high-level disinfectants or the chemical sterilants that are used as high-level disinfectants that are listed on the slide. Now, the next slide is another cartoon. It says Thomas Edison gets his first bottle of pasteurized milk. I could have done that. Then it would have been Edenized milk. And, of course, this refers to the fact that, of course, we have another process called pasteurization. And if you look at the next slide, you'll see a couple pasteurization units. I just wanted to remind myself that, of course, you can use pasteurizers for essentially achieving a process such as high-level disinfection of a semi-critical item. These would be used possibly for anesthesia tubing or respiratory therapy tubing. And, of course, pasteurization is a process of elevated temperature, roughly 160 degrees Fahrenheit or 75 degrees centigrade for approximately 25 minutes. So it's elevated time, elevated temperature in water, and, of course, it kills all microorganisms, again, with the exception of bacterial spores. And there's a great deal of data in the literature that demonstrates that. Now, the next slide will get us to the third category. We talked about critical, we talked about semi-critical, and now we need to say a few words about the non-critical group. And of course, the vast majority of items in our healthcare environment are considered non-critical. Non-critical would be, of course, anything that we have contact with our intact skin. So much of the patient environment would be non-critical. The chairs and the overbed table, the bed rails. Of course, many of the items would be non-critical because they're only having contact with intact skin. Now, the next slide shows you essentially what you're achieving when you're doing low-level disinfection of non-critical items. You can see under object that essentially when you use a low-level disinfectant on a non-critical object, you can expect it to be contaminated with some microorganisms. That is, what you're doing is you're killing the easier-to-kill microorganisms. You're killing the vegetative bacteria and the fungi and the lipid viruses. the easier to kill microorganisms you're not killing, the harder microorganisms to kill, such as mycobacteria or spores, or the harder to kill non-envelope viruses, sometimes referred to as hydrophilic viruses, such as poliovirus or Coxsackie or hepatitis A virus. Now, of course, we have several examples of these non-critical patient care items, like bedpans and crutches and bed rails and EKG leads, bedside tables. All the items that have contact with intact skin are considered non-critical, and we can use a low-level disinfection procedure, or essentially we can use a detergent that is non-antimicrobial for housekeeping surfaces, which we'll discuss in just a few minutes. Now, what are the recommendations going to be as far as the products to use as well as the exposure time for these low-level disinfectants for non-critical objects? And you should have a slide before you that essentially just gives the five germicides that are most commonly used as low-level disinfectants for non-critical objects. Of course, there are always products added to this list to include accelerated hydrogen peroxide, but the products that are listed in the guideline currently include ethyl or isopropyl alcohol, chlorine, phenolic, iodophore, and quaternary ammonium compounds. And you may see a UD there, which means you use the manufacturer's recommended use dilution. And of course, if the phenolic says you should make a 1 to 64 dilution, then that's what you do. You make a 1 to 64 dilution of the phenolic. That's the manufacturer's recommended use dilution. Of course, the recommended use dilution for chlorine, when it's used as a low-level disinfectant for non-critical surfaces, is listed as 100 parts per million. And of course, you have the concentrations of ethyl and isopropyl alcohol, typically in the 70 to 90% range. Now, another important point on this slide is the exposure time. And the exposure time, you can see, is equal to or greater than 1 minute. Now, you can obviously always use exposure times greater than that, but there are studies. In fact, all of the studies that evaluate inactivation of common nosocomial or healthcare-associated pathogens are effective against or affected by a 30-second to 1 minute exposure time using these germicides. That is, I could show you data where we could kill MRSA or VRE or Pseudomonas or Acinetobacter, all the pathogens that are problematic or epidemiologically important in our healthcare environment can be killed in high numbers with exposure times of 30 seconds to 1 minute. So the exposure time that is minimally recommended is a 1 minute exposure time. I should mention also that the typical dry time when you put a germicide on a surface by whatever method you use, whether it's a cellulose wiper or a disposable wiper or possibly a cotton wiper or a microfiber wiper, the typical dry time is greater than 1 minute. Typically, it runs about a minute and a half to 2 minutes. So you would not have to reapply it five or six times to achieve a 10-minute exposure time that is on some label claim. Again, the guideline will say minimum exposure time of 1 minute, although you can, of course, always have a greater exposure time if you desire to do so. Now, the next slide is just going to introduce us to methods in sterilization, and the following slide will essentially identify what sterilization is. So what we've done is we've talked about critical, and we've talked about semi-critical and non-critical items. We're really going to look at the sterilization methods that achieve essentially sterilization for those critical patient care items, those items that have contact with sterile tissue or the vascular system, or sterile body fluid will flow through it. Now, the definition of sterilization is the complete elimination or destruction of all forms of microbial life and is accomplished in a healthcare facility by either physical or chemical processes. The next slide will show you essentially our central processing area where you will see several sterilization units. On the foreground, there's four 100% ethylene oxide units, and then there's a couple vacuum displacement or vacuum sterilizers. And then on the backside, there's a couple hydrogen peroxide gas plasma unit. In another area of central processing, there's even a peracetic acid immersion system, the Steris System 1, which is a chemical sterilization process that requires immersion. So we're going to say a few words about each of these sterilization processes just to give a brief overview. The guideline discusses them in a great deal of detail. The next slide just shows some heat-resistant items that might be used in surgery, and essentially it's just introducing the following slide, which is a list of advantages and disadvantages for steam sterilization. Now, I haven't mentioned, but I typically do mention, that every product and every process has both advantages and disadvantages. There is no ideal or perfect product. There is no ideal or perfect process. You always have to balance the advantages and the disadvantages and select the product or process that fits you and your healthcare institution best. Now, among the sterilization processes, as you can see from the advantages and disadvantages of steam sterilization, this particular process has a number of very significant advantages. In fact, if all items in healthcare were heat resistant, we probably would not have any other sterilization process other than steam. But of course, we do know that we have heat sensitive or heat labile instruments. Therefore, we need some low temperature sterilization technology. But let's quickly say a few things about advantages of steam sterilization. Of course, it's inexpensive, it's non-toxic, it's rapidly microbiocidal, that is, it kills microorganisms very quickly. It is the least affected by organic and inorganic soils. Everything can be affected by organic and inorganic soils, but steam sterilization is a very, very robust sterilization process. It is a very robust sterilization process and a very forgiving process. We don't want to get into what you can do wrong and still get a sterile instrument, but it's a very robust sterilization process, which has a very rapid cycle time. As far as the disadvantages, as I alluded to, one of the disadvantages is, of course, heat is high temperature for a period of time, and of course, it will be deleterious for heat-sensitive instruments. And then, of course, there is a potential for burns, particularly with flash sterilization, if you don't allow the items to cool before they're delivered to the patient care area in surgery. Now, the next slide just shows an item that's going to require low temperature sterilization, and the slide after that will essentially identify some of the sterilization methods that we are using today in our healthcare facility, to include ethylene oxide, to include hydrogen peroxide gas plasma, peracetic acid, and a new method, the ozone sterilization procedure. Now, the next slide just again shows you some sterilizers, and then, of course, it introduces the advantages and disadvantages of ethylene oxide. As far as ethylene oxide is concerned, of course, it is very effective at killing microorganisms. It's not only bactericidal, but viricidal, and mycobactericidal, and, of course, sporicidal. It's compatible with most medical materials. It penetrates medical packaging well, but of course, it, like everything, has disadvantages. And the disadvantages that are most commonly mentioned are the potential hazards to patients and staff. Of course, it is a carcinogen, mutagen, and teratogen. And of course, to minimize or prevent a hazard to patients and staff, we have to do certain things, such as aerate the instruments that are going to be used on our patients, and of course we have to do certain things to minimize occupational exposure of our central processing technicians that work in central processing that may be exposed to ethylene oxide. The other disadvantage is the lengthy cycle and aeration time. For all intents and purposes, it takes 15 to 20 hours before you get a product back from an ethylene oxide sterilization cycle because not only of the cycle time, but of course also because of the aeration time, which is lengthy, which is absolutely essential because you desorb the ethylene oxide, which could cause patient harm if it were not done. Now, the next couple of slides we're just going to run through. They're just showing a STERAD or hydrogen peroxide gas plasma system. First, it's the 100 or the 100S, and then it's the 50, and then it's the new STERAD NX for next generation, and then we'll get to some advantages and disadvantages for the hydrogen peroxide gas plasma system. And you can see several advantages on the slide. It talks about it's safe for the environment and the healthcare worker. There's no toxic residues, and essentially it has a very fast cycle time. The hydrogen peroxide gas plasma system, one of the cycle times is the fastest cycle time for achieving sterilization, a 28-minute cycle time, although it can range from anywhere from 28 to 52 minutes. And of course, because hydrogen peroxide has no toxic residues, there is no need for aeration. Of course, it's a low-temperature sterilization process that is very simple to operate, install, and to monitor. Now, like everything, there are disadvantages. And the next slide identifies some of those disadvantages to include the fact that there are certain endoscopes or there are certain medical devices that you cannot use the hydrogen peroxide gas plasma system with because those endoscopes or those medical devices have a longer lumen or a wider diameter than is allowed in the manufacturer's recommendation. So you always need to look at the manufacturer's recommendations and ensure that you're within the restrictions as it pertains to lumen internal diameter and lumen length. And certainly those manufacturer's recommendations are available to you. They vary a little bit between the 100 and the 100S, the 50 and the NX. And of course, the NX has the most expanded claim with that particular system. And as you also know, you cannot wrap an item requiring hydrogen peroxide gas plasma with something like cellulose or paper because the paper absorbs the hydrogen peroxide and makes the process less effective. So you have to use a synthetic packaging such as a polypropylene wrap when you're employing a hydrogen peroxide gas plasma system. Now the next slide is showing the STERIS System 1, and the following slide will give you the advantages, and then we'll in a minute talk about the disadvantages. But again, another sterilization process with a number of advantages and some disadvantages. Of course, the advantages include that it's a low temperature process, having environmentally friendly byproducts, and of course it's compatible with a wide variety of materials, and we also know that peracetic acid is a very effective antimicrobial in relatively short time period. So this cycle is also relatively fast at between 30 and 45 minutes. Now the disadvantages are on the next slide, and of course there are some disadvantages like everything. One disadvantage is this system is more expensive than, for example, a high-level disinfection procedure if you're using the process for endoscope. There's also some literature which discusses increased endoscope repair costs and operating costs. And, of course, another issue that we need to discuss with this system, it is not a terminal sterilization process. It's a point-of-use system. That is, there is no long-term storage of the instrument that has undergone the peracetic acid sterilization process. It is not wrapped, and therefore, of course, you cannot keep it on a shelf indefinitely. It must be used shortly after the sterilization process is complete. Of course, the other issue, since this is an immersible system, you have to have an instrument that is immersible, because you're going to immerse this instrument in a chemical sterilant, peracetic acid, so the instrument must be immersible. And of course, there's some instruments that there's some material incompatibility issues. To my knowledge, they have always been only cosmetic and not functional in nature. So the things we've talked about with sterilization in the next slide, it just mentions all sterilization processes are effective in killing all microorganisms, including those very resistant spores. And it talks about how important preceding high-level disinfection and sterilization it is to clean the item, because by cleaning, we remove, of course, the salts and the proteins, and, of course, we significantly reduce the microbial load associated with instruments, which we'll see in just a few minutes. And, of course, the last bullet there just alludes to the fact that we always have to make sure that our instruments are exposed to the sterilant. And there has been some failure of sterilization when there was, for example, a failure to use the right connectors between, for example, the Stereosystem 1 and an endoscope. You have to use the right connectors so that there's the right fluidics or forced flow of fluid to include the sterilants through the either semi-critical or critical item that requires either high-level disinfection or sterilization. Now, the next slide mentions essentially methods of sterilization. The guideline talks about methods of sterilization. All it really says is that steam is preferred for critical items that are not damaged by heat. And, of course, we're supposed to follow the operating parameters recommended by the manufacturer. It also talks about using low-temperature sterilization technology for reprocessing critical items damaged by heat. And, of course, there are those heat-sensitive items that we alluded to. It also talks about, with the kerosetic acid immersion system, that there's no long-term storage, which we also mentioned. Now, with flash sterilization, we're not going to talk a lot about flash sterilization, but essentially we have a couple slides, and I just wanted to mention that there are no significant changes as it pertains to flash sterilization in this guideline compared to the 1999 surgical site infections guideline. It mentions essentially that flash is occasionally used, and in the slide that is following the original slide, it talks about that we should not use flash sterilization for reasons of convenience as an alternative to purchasing additional instrument sets or to save time. It also mentions that when we do use flash sterilization, of course, we have to consider certain parameters. The three important parameters include we have to decontaminate the item. The second parameter is that we have to prevent exogenous contamination. So if we don't have the flash sterilized item in a containment pan that is covered, we have to prevent exogenous or extrinsic contamination from contaminating that sterilized item as it's going from the sterilizer to, of course, the patient care area. Then the third parameter is the issue of monitoring. We need to ensure that if we're doing flash sterilization, that we monitor by physical, chemical, and biological monitors. Now, as far as sterilization practices are concerned, if you go a couple slides, you'll see a slide entitled Sterilization Monitoring. And, of course, the guideline talks a great deal about monitoring, and, of course, it talks about that we should monitor routinely by a combination of physical, chemical, and biological parameters. And, of course, the physical monitoring tools include such things as our temperature tapes or our pressure indicators or our cycle time. Chemical monitors are things such as our heat or chemical sensitive dyes that change color when a germicidal related parameter such as temperature has been achieved. And of course, we also have biological parameters and biological spores that directly measure the sterilization process. In the next slide, we see several biological indicators, all of which contain biological spores. And the next slide, we see essentially the spore that is used for each individual sterilization process. For example, we use Geobacillus stereothermophilus for steam because Geobacillus stereothermophilus spores are the most resistant to steam sterilization. We use Bacillus anthropius for dry heat because that spore is the most resistant to dry heat. And of course, we use Bacillus atrophius for ethylene oxide because, again, that spore is most resistant to sterilization. So we use the spore that is most resistant to that sterilization process. So essentially, we're integrating a margin of safety. If it kills these hard-to-kill spores in high numbers, it'll certainly kill the vegetative bacteria that are going to be associated with surgical instruments in relatively low numbers. The next slide just talks a little bit about monitoring. It talks about monitoring each load with physical and chemical indicators, and the chemical indicators should be both internal and external. It also talks about biological indicators, and it mentions that we should use biological indicators to monitor the effectiveness of our sterilizers at least weekly with spores intended for that type of sterilizer. Now, when it says at least weekly, there are certainly some areas of your hospital that you would probably want to use the biological indicators certainly more frequently than weekly. For example, in our central processing area, we run in the steam sterilizers a biological indicator at least daily. And then, of course, if there's implantable items, we run a biological indicator in each load. And that's mentioned in the last bullet where it says use biological indicators for every load containing an implantable item. Now, what do you do if you find a positive biological indicator? Now, you probably are all very familiar with how to manage a positive biological indicator, but following a positive biological indicator, essentially used for method other than steam, we treat as non-sterile all the items that have been processed in that sterilizer dating back to the last negative biological indicator. So if today is Thursday, and we find that we have a positive biological indicator, and we review our records, and the last negative that we had was Monday, we would have to go back and we would have to recall and reprocess all the instruments that were in that particular sterilizer because of the positive biological indicator being found, and essentially the last negative biological indicator being possibly on Monday. Now, as far as storage, you should have a slide that shows you storage in an area. This happens to be storage in our central processing area. The following slide just gives you some general recommendations regarding sterile storage, that it should be well-ventilated area, that provides protection against dust, moisture, and temperature and humidity extremes, and certainly these sterile items should be stored so the packaging is not compromised. It also talks about, of course, our load number system, that is our load indicator system, which identifies the sterilizer used, the SciCor load number, the date of the sterilization, and if applicable, the expiration date. The next slide will show you essentially one of these load numbers. That 02 is the second load in sterilizer number 2. And it's the 189th day. The Julian date is 189, so that would be something like July the 8th, I believe. That essentially is the load number or the load indicator number, and that's how we would recall if there was concern about positive biological indicator or a malfunctioning or improperly functioning sterilizer. The next slide mentions event-related and time-related shelf life. Of course, I think most hospitals today are using event-related shelf life. Of course, that's been used by industry for quite some time and recognizes that the product remains sterile and until an event occurs or causes it to become contaminated. An event might be wetness or it might be tearing. And of course, once the integrity of the package is compromised, that package should be considered, and the items within that package, non-sterile. And, of course, the packages should be evaluated before use for loss of integrity. So if they are found to be torn or wet in the OR, of course, those materials should not be used. The next topic is disinfection and sterilization of emerging pathogens. Without going through a lot of detail, you should see a list of a number of emerging pathogens such as hepatitis C and Clostridium and Cryptosporidium and so forth. All of these microbes are inactivated by our current high-level disinfection procedures, our current sterilization processes. So if you have a semi-critical item contaminated with one of these microbes, our current processes will inactivate that emerging pathogen or that pathogen of interest. And that's what the next slide says. It says standard disinfection and sterilization procedures for patient care equipment are adequate to sterilize or disinfect instruments or devices contaminated with blood and other body fluids from persons infected with emerging pathogens. So we don't have to worry about doing anything differently for any microbe with the exception of the proteinaceous infectious agent referred to as prion. Now the next slide is just a break slide because we're going to get into another area. The last several minutes we're going to talk about some significant revisions as it pertains to the guidelines. And the first significant revision we're going to talk about is surface disinfection. So you should have a slide that says surface disinfection and essentially disinfecting non-critical patient care items. I wanted to briefly mention this to you because there's a bit of controversy about this. Essentially, we process non-critical patient care equipment with an EPA-registered disinfectant at the proper use solution and a contact time of at least 1 minute. What is that saying? It's saying if we had something like a blood pressure cuff or an EKG lead that has had contact with intact skin, we would only need to wipe it off with a EPA-registered germicidal disinfectant such as a quad or a phenolic with a 1 minute exposure time. Next bullet says, ensure that the frequency for disinfecting non-critical patient care surfaces be done minimally when visibly soiled and on a regular basis. And that regular basis is really defined by your policy. And the reason that the CDC does not define it more specifically is that there are no data which allow it to be defined more specifically. There are no data that says that it should be after each patient use versus once daily versus once weekly. So essentially it is by your institutional policy what that frequency for disinfecting non-critical patient care surfaces is. The next slide talks about not the non-critical patient care objects, but environmental surfaces. And it says, disinfect or clean housekeeping surfaces such as floors and countertops on a regular basis when spills occur and when these surfaces are visibly soiled. Now, what's the regular basis? Again, it's not defined. It's defined by your institutional policy. The next bullet says, use disinfectant for housekeeping purposes where there is uncertainty existing as to the nature of the soil on the surface, that is, you can't tell the difference between a blood versus dirt, or where there's uncertainty existing regarding the presence of a multiply drug-resistant organism on the surface. So it says you could use a non-germicidal detergent on housekeeping surfaces, except there's a Category 2 recommendation if there's uncertainty as to the nature of the soil on the surface or if there's uncertainty regarding the presence of multiply drug-resistant organisms. In those cases, it's a Category 2 recommendation to use a disinfectant. The next slide is C. difficile, and we're going to go through this quickly, but I do want to mention that there are some emerging pathogens and there are some specific recommendations regarding some of these emerging pathogens. You probably have a slide up that says environmental contamination. Without going through a lot of detail, if you have a patient that is colonized or infected with C. difficile, it is likely that there is going to be significant contamination of the environment. Maybe 30% of the environmental cultures would be positive for C. difficile. It could even be higher in rooms of patients who have C. difficile-associated diarrhea. It could be as high as 50%. The next slide just says that when you have a lot of environmental contamination, you're likely to have a lot of hand contamination. You may see a yellow highlighted bullet which says greater than 50% environmental sites positive, 36% of the hand cultures are positive. The point is when you have a lot of environmental contamination, you have a lot of hand contamination, and with a lot of hand contamination and poor hygiene, you have a risk of cross-transmission. The next slide just mentions that C. difficile, of course, is a spore-forming organism, so you have to kill the spores. Fortunately, these spores are not quite as resistant as some other spores. So these spores, while resistant, can be inactivated by products such as chlorine at elevated concentrations, or by products such as glutaraldehyde and ortho-aldehyde and peracetic acid. And that's what that slide says. Essentially, you get a very significant reduction of even the epidemic strain of C. difficile with the products that we commonly use for high-level disinfection and even low-level disinfection, that is chlorine-containing products, when we use elevated concentrations. The next slide just gives you a recommendation. The second bullet, which is highlighted in yellow, says in units with high endemic C. difficile infection rates or in an outbreak or epidemic setting, you should use dilute solutions of the 5.25% sodium hypochlorite for routine disinfection. Now, 5.25% is what you typically buy at a grocery store. It generally is between 5.25% and 6.15%. And all you need to do is make a 1 to 10 dilution, and that's what we use when we have a high endemic or an outbreak situation with C. difficile. Now, we do not use it for normal C. difficile in the absence of an outbreak situation or a high endemic C. difficile infection rate situation. Adenovirus 8. I want to mention very few comments regarding adenovirus 8, another change in the guideline. Of course, adenovirus 8 is a cause of epidemic keratoconjunctivitis. And of course, it's related to eye instruments such as an applanation thermometer, which you probably have before you. I'm looking at a slide that's entitled adenovirus 8 now, and it just mentions very quickly that adenovirus 8 essentially can survive on instruments and environmental surfaces for a long period of time, up to 30 days or so. And of course, adenovirus 8 can be present on those surfaces and certainly can contaminate ophthalmic instruments, and it's essential in preventing outbreaks of epidemic keratoconjunctivitis that we kill organisms such as adenovirus 8. Now, the next slide will give you the CDC recommendations from 1985. And without going in detail, you can see that there's four products that are recommended. 5,000 parts per million chlorine, 3% hydrogen peroxide, and 70% ethyl or isopropyl alcohol. The next slide will show you that two of those products has recently been shown to be not effective, the 70% isopropyl alcohol and 3% hydrogen peroxide will not kill adenovirus 8, which is the most common cause of epidemic keratoconjunctivitis. What will kill among those products, the adenovirus 8, is of course high levels of chlorine, approximately 5,000 to 6,000 parts per million of chlorine, which is a 1 to 10 dilution of that household bleach you buy at the grocery store, or 70% ethanol. So the new recommendation, you should see a slide that says CDC guidelines, the new recommendation will not list four products. It'll only list two products. It'll list 5,000 parts per million chlorine, and it'll list 70% ethyl alcohol, category 2 recommendation to use one or the other of those products after the tonometer tip, the applanation tonometer, has been wiped off. They should then be disinfected by immersing in one of those two products for 5 to 10 minutes. Now, real quickly, we're going to go over CJD. The next slide should be a slide entitled Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease disinfection and sterilization. The following slide just mentions that CJD or prions are very, very resistant to inactivation by our normal sterilization and disinfection procedure. The next slide just mentions that what we're really trying to do is we're trying to prevent secondary spread through contaminated surgical instruments. And without going through a lot of detail, the guideline will say, and you'll see in the next slide, it'll say that we need to do a risk assessment. A risk assessment as it pertains to special prion reprocessing. When we have a high-risk patient, a high-risk tissue, and a high-risk medical device, we need to use special prion reprocessing. So a high-risk device would be a critical or semi-critical device. A high-risk tissue would be one of those tissues that have high levels of prions in them, and that includes brain, spinal cord, and eye. And a high-risk patient, of course, would be someone that is either known or suspected with CJD or one other of the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. And when we have that situation, you can go to the next slide. When we have that situation where we have a high-risk patient, high-risk medical device, and high-risk tissue, we have to do what is called special prion reprocessing, where we use high temperature for longer periods of time. Rather than just 132 centigrade for 4 minutes, we use 134 centigrade for 18 minutes. So it's a higher temperature, longer time. That's special prion reprocessing. These prions are very resistant to an activation by our sterilization processes as well as our chemicals that we use for high-level disinfection or, in that matter, chemical sterilization. So special prion reprocessing is needed for persons with high-risk tissue, high-risk medical device, and, of course, high-risk patients. The next slide just says inactivation of prions, and essentially it just introduces the concept that maybe someday soon we will not have to do any longer special prion reprocessing. There are some new data which suggest that some of the enzymatic detergents and the alkaline detergents may be able to be integrated, for example, into our washer disinfectors and may be able to reduce or prevent exposure of patients to this prion because of the effectiveness of these alkaline and enzymatic detergents. The next slide is endoscopes and AERs. We could spend an hour on endoscopes. We really don't have an hour, but a few minutes left. I just wanted to mention to you, of course, endoscopes are extremely important. Extremely important because in the inanimate environment, endoscopes represent really the greatest risk of disease transmission. It's not surgical instruments because essentially our sterilization processes are so robust that we have very little risk associated with the critical items. Certainly there would be risk if there's contamination, but our sterilization processes are just so effective that it removes that risk. And with our semi-critical items, we just cannot do anything wrong. The practices have to be, and the policies have to be religiously followed because there's just so many microorganisms associated with these endoscopes. The second bullet there, you may see endoscopes contaminated during use. A GI endoscope has a billion, 10 to the ninth, a billion microorganisms on the inside of that scope. Now, a surgical instrument, 85% of surgical instruments have less than 100. 30 to 40% of surgical instruments are completely sterile or devoid of microbial contamination after use in surgery. Now, compare that to an endoscope where you have 10 to the 9th or a billion microorganisms. We have to effectively clean these instruments, and we have to effectively high-level disinfect them to prevent transmission of infection. And, of course, these semi-critical items require minimally high-level disinfection. The next slide just gives you some example of the types of infections that have been transmitted associated with gastrointestinal endoscopy as well as bronchoscopy. You can see the frequency and the type of microorganisms. For GI endoscopy, we see things like Salmonella and Pseudomonas, and with bronchoscopy, we see Mycobacteria. The next slide just shows you the five essential steps. We really can't go through them, but of course, it's extremely important that we follow these steps and follow the professional recommendations or the professional guidelines, and of course that we have practices that are consistent with those professional guidelines and our own policies. The five steps include cleaning, of course high-level disinfection, rinsing, drying, and storing. Cleaning and high-level disinfection are extremely important because, of course, cleaning removes the microorganisms and high-level disinfection and sterilization inactivates the microorganism. The next slide just shows that we have to monitor the minimum effective concentration of our antimicrobials that we use for high-level disinfection of semi-critical items. And of course, the next slide just shows that that over time, there is dilution of those products during use. And the dilution occurs over time, and we need to make sure that we use a minimally effective concentration. The next slide just gives us some recommendations regarding that monitoring activity at the minimum effective concentration. It talks about that dilution that occurs during use, and it mentions for glutaraldehyde that we can never go below the 1.5%. For orthothialdehyde, we cannot go below 0.3%. Why? Because if you go below those concentrations, the product will no longer kill the microorganisms that could be associated with the endoscope and prevent transmission of infection. The next slide just shows, of course, monitoring as well as recording that information regarding minimum effective concentration. And the next slide, the last slide on endoscopy, it talks about endoscopy safety. Very, very important. It says, ensure that the protocols are equivalent to guidelines from professional organizations. That would include the CDC guidelines. Ensure that the staff that reprocess the endoscopes are specifically trained to do the job. Temporary persons should not do the job. These persons have to be trained, and of course they have to be competency tested at commencement of employment, and it has to be competency tested at least annually thereafter. Then it also talks about conducting infection control rounds to ensure compliance with policy. So we have to have good policy, which is compliant with professional organizational guidelines like the CDC. We have to have practice that is consistent with that policy, and we need to perform rounds to ensure that our practices are consistent with our policies, which of course are consistent with the professional organizational guidelines to prevent transmission of infection. The last couple things I'm going to talk about, one is endocavitary probes. And you should have an endocavitary probe before you, and I want to say a couple words about endocavitary probes. There are, of course, comments about this in the guideline. The guideline will mention, of course, the frequent use of endocavitary probes like vaginal probes and rectal probes, and it will mention that there is a tendency to essentially downgrade the level of disinfection for this semi-critical item that touches mucous membranes because commonly these probes have covers. They have covers or condoms or sheaths that cover the probe. But it should be mentioned, and the third bullet does mention it, that you cannot depend on that condom or probe cover or sheath because the high frequency of failure of those sheaths. Data has demonstrated that anywhere from 1 to 80% failure rate associated with these sheaths even before use. So you must still perform high-level disinfection of this semi-critical item even though there is a sheath that is used because the sheath may have holes or lack integrity. There could be contamination of the probe and transmission by that mechanism. One of the last comments is going to be on rinse water. There's a lot of interest on what rinse water to use, and there's a couple comments in the guideline about that. It says use sterile water, filtered water, or tap water, followed by an alcohol rinse for semi-critical equipment to contact mucous membranes of the upper respiratory tract, category 2. But the next bullet says there is no recommendation to use sterile water or filtered water rather than tap water for rinsing semi-critical equipment that will have contact with the mucous membrane of the rectum, such as a rectal probe, or the vagina, such as a vaginal probe. So there's no recommendation regarding whether you have to use sterile water, filtered water, versus tap water for those kinds of probes after immersion in a product such as a high-level disinfectant like glutaraldehyde or orthothialdehyde. We're going to say very little regarding the reuse of single-use devices. We're just going to say, essentially, that there are FDA rules regarding reuse of single-use medical devices, and, of course, we have to follow those rules. And the last slide that I have is entitled Recommendations and Quality Control. And essentially what that says is, of course, we have to provide comprehensive and intensive training for all of our staff that are assigned to reprocess medical and surgical instruments. There has to be hands-on training. There has to be supervised training until competency is documented, and of course, competency testing should be conducted at commencement of employment and regularly for people that are reprocessing semi-critical items and critical items in our healthcare environment. So we go to the last slide, and essentially I think we've done, with just a few seconds to spare, everything that we said we were going to do. We went through an awful lot very quickly, but remember the guideline is 300 pages with about 20 pages of recommendations. We reviewed essentially the principles of disinfection and sterilization, the recommendations, all of which was in the guideline, and we talked about some significant revisions such as surface disinfection, emerging pathogens and prions, endoscope reprocessing, and of course, the reprocessing of semi-critical items such as endocavitary probes and applanation tonometers. So with probably seconds to spare, I thank you very much for spending the afternoon with me. I'm sorry we probably don't have too much time for questions, but again, I thank you for being here with me this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rotella, for another outstanding teleclass lecture. As you say, there's so much in there that could be broadened into half a dozen different teleclass lectures, each of them an hour or two long, and I'm looking forward to maybe expanding on those a little bit in the future. Thank you very much for that. Folks, if you've not yet discovered our recordings library at webertraining.com, it is a free access area where there are more than 100 teleclass recordings and handouts from past years. And there are, in fact, several outstanding Rotella teleclasses posted there as well. Thanks very much to Virox Technologies for their support of this teleclass and of infection control as a whole. The very last slide that you'll note there is an addition to our teleclass schedule, again, a free teleclass with Dr. Elaine Larson. Now, this is a lecture that she's giving, a keynote lecture at the Infection Control Nurses Association conference in England in September, and they're broadcasting that live to their members in the UK, and also they're inviting the rest of the world to join and listen to that lecture as well. That one will be free. Thank you again to everyone for joining us today, and a special thanks to Dr. Bill Rotella for doing a marvelous job yet again. Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you all again very soon. Goodbye.